Hello and welcome to the 13th Hour Podcast. This is your host, Joshua Blum, and this is episode number 87. Today we have a special guest, Joshua Robertson, who is a dark fantasy author who was actually on the show in episode number 32 over a year ago, and he came back to talk about some of the exciting things that are in store for him over this next year and some of the things that have happened to him in the year since we've actually talked. Quite a bit has changed. I'll let you hear from him exactly what those exciting things are. But if you are interested in writing, if you're interested in learning more about how authors create what they do, if you're interested in just fantasy, just in general, Dungeons and Dragons, that kind of thing, or if you found last week's podcast episode interesting, where different authors talked about their creative process and how they go about doing what they do, then you will also find this episode interesting. There's quite a lot to share there. So I will turn it over to Josh and let him tell you that. At the end of the episode, there's going to be a preview of one of the upcoming tracks that I'll be releasing. And I think it's like a nice, slow kind of way to come down to the end. I guess I decided to put it in because in many ways, this particular track was influenced by some of the music from the film The Crow, some of the slower, more introspective pieces, which is sort of a dark fantasy slash martial arts movie, if you've ever seen it. Unfortunately, Brandon Lee was killed during the making of that movie, which is a total downer way to start this podcast, I know. But it's like the anniversary of his death was just a couple of days ago on the 31st of March. So the making of this particular track is sort of a slow kind of, I guess in a way, homage to some of the work from that soundtrack, which is done by Graham Revel. So you can get more information about that in the show notes, and that will be available on Bandcamp in the next couple of weeks. The information about Josh and where you can find his work is also available in the show notes, and he has multiple ways of contacting him through Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and so forth. So you can check all that stuff out. But without further ado, let's get to the podcast. Take care, and I will talk to you guys next week. Enjoy. I am very happy to have Joshua Robertson back again for another podcast. And if you remember, we were just trying to figure out, like, I think it's been over a year, but it's definitely been, there's a lot of stuff that's happened between now and the last time that we talked. And so we wanted to catch up and see what else is new for Josh on the horizon. So thanks for joining us here, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Joshua. It's been an exciting year and a half, and it's wonderful to kind of come back on and check in with your listeners and let them know the crazy, wild train I've been riding for a while now.
Yeah. Well, you were just saying that you made the leap to full-time author, so congratulations. And
yeah, thank you.
Yep. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been about 9 months now since I finally decided to make that choice and jump into full authorship. I knew that I was finishing up my trilogy this year, and I've just had great support from my fans and my readers, and they've given me the opportunity to finally go all the way in terms of writing books.
Wow. So, you know, this is the question I think that everybody always asks, like, you know, how long did it take you to get there? And I think we talked about this for the very first time we talked, but you know, obviously, if you take out like all the life experience and stuff like that that's come up to now, from the point that you started writing to making the leap to full time, if you had to ballpark it, what do you think?
I got to clarify your question. From the time I started writing or the time I started publishing?
The time you started publishing, because, you know, you could have been writing since you were 5 years old, and you may have written.
Yeah, I had my first book published in 2015. So that's when the first novel came out. So it's been a little over 2 years now, but I have published 5 full-length novels in that 2.5 years. And I've also had fully published 14 different publications. So I know that I write a little bit quicker than most folks do. I think when we talked last time, we said that usually it's after your third novel that you start seeing enough income to come in. But the recent numbers I've seen is really closer to 5 to 7.
5 to 7, yeah. And I mean, do you think that just because the third novel, is that like sort of an older stat, like from days before the market got as saturated or?
I think it really is. I've been fortunate to really bond with writers that are more successful than myself in the past 6 to 8 months. And many of them started writing around 2011, 2012, and they've seen success fairly quickly after their third novel, where they were able to move fully into writing. And again, in fantasy, we know that the trilogy is fairly popular. And so oftentimes you see that writers were finishing up trilogies fairly quickly and then getting them out there and running with it. I did make the mistake of not finishing my trilogy first. I wrote the first novel, and then I wrote a prelude novel, and then I wrote novel two, and then I went and wrote another one and another one, and then I went and finished up the trilogy. And so that itself slowed me down in terms of being able to move full time.
Do you think it mattered though, like I know that's what they say, the common wisdom is to pump them out, like the series and everything like that. But do you think it mattered that you took a little time in between and sort of did some other things?
You know,
Or,
I honestly think that it did. I had readers that were wanting to finish reading the series, and when you have a certain amount of time pass between books coming out, they lose interest. And like you said, the market is so saturated now, there's easily another series to pick up and to kind of fall in love with, and they can forget that yours exists. I've seen writers now that are writing full series and getting the entire trilogy done before they put out book one, just for that reason, so that they can hold readers' interest.
And it's always the thing, like because if you want to devote the time and to it, then it's not as necessarily easy to kind of pump them out that fast. And but it's great that you're able to do it. I know you I know there was a sort of reissue of one of your first books, a new cover, and can you talk a little bit about, the decision behind doing that, and is that sort of to tie in with stuff for this year, for example?
Absolutely. That's actually a great question. I was sitting on a panel last week about book covers, and they asked me the same question there too, on why did I end up refurnishing some of my covers and what I was doing. A lot of it had to do with branding. My first cover for Malcorca, which is the first book in my series, is pretty bland. It just has a symbol on the front of it. And then the second cover was a little bit more dynamic, with a tree and some color and contrast that really made it shine. When I went to go write the third book, I realized that I really needed to stick with the same concept as book number two, in terms of branding. But in order to do that, I had to change book number one to fit the same scheme. Otherwise, if you had had them all three on a shelf, you would have never known that they were of the same series, which could have been very confusing for readers. And then I also redid the cover for the prelude book, Annerfell. I completely revamped that one and got rid of the symbol that was on the front as well, with a very dynamic image of the two brothers fighting in the battle against the three-headed dragon. And I guess the more and more that I've learned, which I'm sure you've seen this as too, is the cover is probably the largest piece that you can invest in. It's the first thing that readers are going to see. And with so many books on the market, you want something that's going to pull the reader's eye.
Yeah, I remember seeing the new covers, and it's always hard because I think when you look at the covers, the people see a tiny little snapshot of it on Amazon when they're browsing them, sort of just online, and they're kind of scrolling through, and that makes it it's like a special kind of thing to make sure that there's a sort of enough detail on the cover to for it to actually show something, but not so fine that it all gets lost in like the little thumbnail. And
I completely agree with you. I talked to a guy that said he scrolls through covers every single day, and essentially it's just quick scrolling down the screen to see what is newly available. And he says if your cover can't make him stop in his quick scroll, then you've lost him. And I think that a lot of readers have that same mentality. They're just scrolling through covers day after day, and you got to have something that's going to make them pause for 3 seconds and blow up the image and look at it a bit closer.
It's you had when we were talking just offline, you had mentioned starting to this year going to Comic Cons and these kind of convention kind of things, and it's can you talk a little bit about that, and what was this decision to do all this? I mean, how does that factor into these more public appearances where like the maybe that's less of an issue, that quick sort of thing?
That's actually, I think they go hand in hand in some ways. We talked about it a little bit offline too. You know, my social media has grown fairly tremendously in the few years that I've been publishing and building up a tribe behind me and fans behind me. And I have kind of reached some barriers online on how far I can go without just being annoying in terms of advertising and trying to draw in more people. And so I've looked at doing more things like Comic-Cons and podcasts and radio shows. And one of the things that I've heard about Comic-Cons is, and you've been to them, I've been to a couple myself, is that it's really the booth and the covers and the design of that booth that draws readers in to check out more about what's going on. I heard a guy talk not too long ago about if a reader will stop at your booth, you're almost guaranteed to make a sale, but you have so much foot traffic going by, there's very few that actually get drawn over to the table to check out your books and look at them a little bit more. Yeah. So in doing that, you need to have, you know, those retractable banners or something that's going to draw the traffic over to your booth to want to pick up your book and read the back cover and see if the blurb is of interest to them.
Yeah, and the ones you've been to is the sort of ones you've been to. Were you there as a vendor, or there just sort of browsing? And
you know, I was there as a browser. I was there as a reader. Yeah. And I'll tell you, it's so crowded. You have so many people, and you go through the artist alley or through the vendor area, and there's just table upon table that's smashed together, and everyone's trying to get your attention, and it's hard to even take it all in. There's so much visual. You know, what's the word I'm looking for? visual candy, I guess, pull you in, that it all just gets lost into a blur of colors a lot of times.
Right. Yeah. Sort of a lot of stimuli for the, And I don't know the answer to this. I mean, I've only sold stuff at two, basically, two large ones and then a bunch of smaller things. But it kind of seems like I'm still trying to figure out the best layout for. Is it, do you have a lot of stuff on your table that's visually kind of appealing, or do you have very few things that doesn't distract the person? Because I think sometimes they, you know, the eye just sort of wanders and they don't know where to focus on. And I don't know.
I know I have a couple of plans. I don't know if I want to tell you what those are on the air for what I'm going to do, but I have a few ideas. I've talked with a number of different vendors and people's responses who have been at Comic-Cons about what pulls them in. And so I'm hoping that my strategy in going to those is effective to at least talk to readers. Yeah. And even if they don't immediately pick up my book and buy it, which is totally cool, at least I can connect with fans and see what their interests are.
Yeah. Well, we can talk in another year. You can reflect on the experience and what you felt worked and what didn't. So, but yeah, that's cool. I mean, they're kind of I think it's a fun kind of environment to be in. So,
I love them. It's so much fun. I love seeing the people that do the cosplay that are running around and people that are stopping and taking pictures with different displays that are put up. I mean, it's like you go there and you're like, I'm finally with my people. I mean, it's just it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. I'm always amazed at the time and the energy people put into the costumes and that whole thing. I mean, it just blows me away.
Yeah. Well, and I think you said it, but I'm going down to the one in Pensacola in August. So if any of your listeners are in that area and want to stop by and see me, that's where I'll be at. But Pensacola is huge. It's probably going to be one of the biggest events I've ever been at.
Yeah,
and we went out of our way and we got a corner booth. And so we're hoping that we can really essentially interact with more people. I'm going to be down there. Lillian Oak, who's another fantasy author, will be sharing that booth with me and selling her own books, trying to drag my co-author down there, but we'll still see if that happens.
Well, that's awesome, because then you got two people. That means that one person can go eat and one person can be in the booth, and the other person, you know, like someone can act, you can actually go to the bathroom, and that's you already got a leg up. I think you've already got two people doing it. So cool. So so tell us a little bit about some of these some of the things that are coming for this year.
Well, I had some great news that came up this week, which we chatted about a little bit, but I got accepted with Fantasy Faction, which is a website online, a huge blogging community and fantasy community. I'm very excited about that. I get to essentially write a column more or less for them every month, where I'll be writing about book covers, nuances in the fantasy world, and I'll be grabbing some arcs from some authors who I can't reveal at this time, but I'll be grabbing their arcs and giving reviews about their upcoming fantasy novels, and they're pretty big folks, so I'm pretty excited about snagging those early. And then, of course, talk about Pensacola. I'll be doing that. There's another convention we're looking at going to in South Carolina that's called Oh, what is it? I want to say, I got a paper over here next to me. Of course, I'm not going to be able to read it right off the... Oh, Soda City. There we go. Soda City Comic Con. We'll be down at that one in Columbia this year as well. This last 2 weeks has been kind of a blur because I've been on probably the radio 5 to 7 times in the past 2 weeks. And it's been exhausting.
Yeah.
So I've kind of just now coming off tour. This is actually the last interview of that tour that I've been doing. But we'll see what else comes out. I'm traveling to San Antonio, going to be going to Arizona this year. Uh-huh. I'm heading back into Kansas, which is my home state this year. I'm going to be all over the map.
Yeah. Well, I know that you recently had a book come out just earlier this month, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yep. I just finished up Maharia, which was the third book in the Kalandar series. And I know those are really hard words to pronounce and spell, it's in the Thrice Nine Legends saga, which is really easy to find. And this was the third book in the series, completing it up. This particular story follows a slave who is bent on trying to protect the ash tree and the world being destroyed from demons. And so you follow his adventures for 1,200 years. They live a little while he is essentially fending off demons and trying to keep the world tree or the tree of life safe.
Yeah. So this is the trilogy that you were talking about earlier. So congratulations, on finishing that.
Thank you.
I know it was, if I'm not mistaken, I know it's been a pretty long time coming, right? It's like we're talking years at this point of thinking about the story and building the characters and everything like that.
It is. It's been a 3-year process. I released a book, one in 2015, one in 2016, and then one in 2017 for this trilogy.
Yeah. But if I remember right, there was years of thinking about the characters, right? If that's...
I started the trilogy actually almost 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I wrote the first book 7 or 8 times. I never can really remember, but about 8 times I wrote it in completion and then trashed the entire book and started over again.
Right. I mean, that's just one of those good, I think, nuggets, to take away things, for people who are listening. I mean, you don't have to be a writer. I mean, just not giving up and not necessarily... even if it doesn't work out the first, second, third, whatever time, just continuing at it, just plugging away, and then eventually it starts to click into place.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, I felt so good after I finished my first book. It was so wonderful to finally finish the book and be like, okay, I'm done with this. But to finish the trilogy, it's 100 times better than that. It's like you finally have completed something in its entirety. I don't know if all authors across genres feel that same way, but I think for a fantasy author to finally finish the full of a story in 3 books is just an overwhelming feeling.
Yeah. Well, fantasy stuff is so long usually, right? It's long.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this won't be the end of these characters necessarily. I've explained this before, too.
Yeah.
My books are like the Dragonlance books that are out there by Weiss and Hickman, where I have series within the saga and I have standalone novels within the saga. So I finished up a trilogy within the saga, but there will be more books that are in the same world, and you may see cameos come across from characters in that same world in other books.
The extended universe, like Stephen King.
Yes.
Doing that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool, right? When you read another book and then you see a little guest appearance by one of the guys in there, gals in the other book. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's going to be like.
Right.
Yep. Annerfell, of course, is the prelude of the series. And so we already have some cameos in that from the series. Right now we're working on the sequel to Annerfell, which it'll just be a 2-piece story.
Sure.
And we're finishing that one up. But I'm also currently writing 2 standalones simultaneously that will also be in the same world.
Yeah. And do you find that the standalone pieces, is it sort of bridging the gap to something in the future or expanding the universe, or how do you see those pieces fitting in?
They're definitely supplements, even around the series. One of the standalones that I'm writing right now is the origin story to the antagonist in the main series. So you're getting We're actually going back in time, and we're seeing why he became the bad guy that he became.
Oh, nice.
You get to see his childhood and what he went through, and you get to connect with him as a character, which I'm having a lot of fun with, because we know as writers that you want your readers to connect with that main character in the book.
Right.
And so you're going to see everything from his perspective about why he thought he was the good guy.
Right. Yeah. Which makes him a sympathetic character.
Yeah.
Villain, I guess. Or, you know.
And it'll make the series that much more impactful when you get the other side of the coin.
Yeah. No, I like it. You know, I had mentioned earlier that the whole Dungeons & Dragons connection and everything like that. How did that, you know, you've been doing that for quite a while. How has that played into your writing, and has that influenced it in any way?
Absolutely, Josh. I've been playing Dungeons & Dragons since I was about 13 or 14 years old. Started way back at the 2.0 edition, and as I shared with you, I'm just now starting to get into 5th edition. I'm honestly at 3.5 edition. I played that one the longest. That's kind of the one that I'm stuck in. But in playing Dungeons & Dragons, you get, depending on who your playing party is, you really get into the characters and their storyline and who they are as people, and you learn a lot about the duality that takes place in fantasy worlds, whether you're looking at politics or you're looking at religion, or you're looking at society and how it functions and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable morally. And so it really lets you see multiple scopes of perspective in terms of not necessarily black and white, but the gray that falls in there.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's helped me a lot in terms of writing dynamic characters. Mm-hmm. Some of my characters have come out of games that I've played, where I've had a character that I played for years, and it's like, yeah, how do I take some of that character's traits and put it into the story for who I'm writing about now?
Sure.
That's definitely taken place.
Yeah. And I imagine the opposite probably has happened too, where you start to create scenarios for the games that you play based on, you know, your books and your
world. Absolutely. Those first 10 years when I was rewriting the novel over and over again, those first 10 years and rewriting the novel over and over again, I took my players through my world and had them essentially meet my NPCs that were in my books and interact with them and engage with them, which helped me flesh out what some of those characters were and what they acted like.
Were there scenarios where, based on something that happened in the game that you didn't necessarily expect, that you ended up changing or modifying your story? It's like, oh, that was an interesting twist that just, you know, the dynamics of how things happen in these games may not necessarily be something you anticipated. And so were there any scenarios where you you recall it changing your actual writing, sort of the art imitates life kind of thing, I guess?
That's a really good question. I would not be able to say that it didn't. It's been so long since I traversed those waters that I'm not sure if it did, but I can definitely imagine that taking place.
Yeah.
Of course, I kind of like, whenever I was playing the game, I let characters do what they wanted to do in my world and explore it fairly freely. So there was a lot of things that occurred in the world or where Dungeons & Dragons meshed with my fantasy world that didn't really make a whole lot of sense. D&D is obviously a high fantasy genre that's very much based around Tolkien-esque type of creatures and characters and monsters, where all my books are based off Slavic mythology, and Russian mythology and, you know, even Middle Eastern mythology. And so I oftentimes created my own monsters to kind of weasel into the game whenever the players let me.
Sure. And, you know, like my brother was telling me this, I never actually played Dungeons & Dragons. I've only, you know, sort of heard about it secondhand. That's
a shame.
Yeah, I know. You know, I never, you know, it's, yeah. You know, but that sort of thing happens though, right? I mean, it's sort of like you're given sort of artistic liberty to do that. From what I understand, at least, I don't know. But
yeah, absolutely. I've seen so many different variations of Dungeons & Dragons and games and what people have done. Even for a while, we were playing Dungeons & Dragons and we were incorporating Magic the Gathering cards in the actual game.
Sure.
Where people are having to bring those out in order to cast spells. I mean, we've blended and played with different rules. And yeah, I think you're at liberty, depending on house rules and what you do all the time.
Right. Yeah, I was recently at a Comic-Con, and it was a panel, it was a Q&A kind of panel about sci-fi, fantasy, kind of world-building kind of stuff. And so one of the questions that an audience member asked was about, you know, building sort of, you know, how to go about building characters ground up. And, you know, we started talking a little bit about these kind of things. And the whole process of creating a character that you might use in a game, you know, all the different characteristics, not just physical ones, and but also sort of the emotional side of it, the sort of the thinking and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I know I wish I had known about that when I was creating characters for books I was writing. I mean, I'll probably use that in the future, but I don't know if you found that sort of process is so detailed, like all the different, you know, things that you might do to create this character. Is that something that you find yourself doing when you write, or does it happen more on a sort of unconscious level now?
No, I definitely do. I've talked about this on many shows before. I'm a plotter through and through, and I even plot out my characters, and I'm pretty detailed in who they are. Sometimes they surprise me, and I have to go back to the drawing board and pause my writing process. But for the most part, I plan them out. D&D definitely had a piece on that. I think 5th edition is a little bit more descriptive in the character building process than what previous editions were. But even when I played, I was always big on the role-playing aspect of it. So I made my characters pretty deep in terms of their personality and their characteristics and the way that they think.
Yeah.
And so in building characters for novels, I do a very similar process. I find 5 things that I really like about the character that are positive traits that I want to shine in the novel. And then I take 2 things that are just really terrible characteristics for the character that they have to overcome throughout their experiences in the novel. Yeah. And it balances them and makes them lovable, but at the same time, it gives them these quirks that are kind of difficult to understand, or it gives them something to struggle with.
Yeah, or more like real people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that information actually comes out of a book called The Fantasy Fiction Formula by Deborah Chester.
Uh-huh.
Great book for anybody who wants to write fantasy. It's a great novel, and it goes through all the information, plot building, character building, structure, arc, all that sort of stuff. She does a wonderful job in explaining how to really write best-selling fantasy.
I'll put a link in the show notes for folks who are interested in that. And there was another thing that you had mentioned before, Fantasy Faction, which I've never heard about, but I probably should. Do you say a little bit about that and how that plays into all this stuff?
Yeah, Fantasy Faction is an online community for nerds and fantasy contributors who want to come and try and get the latest news on books, movies, comics, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And so I've recently been adopted into their family as a contributor / blogger / columnist for their website, where I'll be putting up a story about once a month on their site, either directly related to indie writers and tips to help them in terms of writing, book reviews, or just what's up and coming in the fantasy world.
Wow, that sounds like a great opportunity.
It's such an awesome gig. I was pretty honored. There was quite a few applicants that were trying for their position, so I was completely humbled by getting accepted into that.
You had mentioned that it's going to be a regular column. Is it some nonfiction sort of stuff you're talking about writing in general, or is it also stories that you're working on, or some of both?
It probably actually won't do a lot with me personally and what I'm working on.
Sure.
It will be, I know one of the reasons that I came on board with them is to write information like how to make a best-selling book cover for indie authors, things to focus on, you know, how to create a good villain in your fantasy story to make it believable and to draw the reader in.
Yeah.
So I'll be writing things like that are more, I guess, nonfiction in their creation. But I'll also be doing things like book reviews and, you know, maybe recaps about the cons that I go to and what the big fuss is and what's going on there, too.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, so it sounds like it'd be a great resource for anybody who's sort of interested in this kind of field.
I think so. They do a lot of stuff on there too about gaming and tabletop gaming and Dungeons and Dragons and all that too. So they have, I want to say, somewhere between 30 and 50 contributors that write for them. So every day there's something up on their blog that's going on about something new in the fantasy world.
Yeah. Which, you know, if you look over sort of into the future, one of the things that people often will say about fantasy, it seems like things are just recycled over and over and over again, you know, recreating Tolkien and this kind of stuff. But, you know, is that true in your kind of experience, and what is your take on all that?
Josh, it's like you've been stalking me for the past week. I was on a panel a week ago where we talked about the past 80 years in fantasy and how, where we've come from since Tolkien. Real quick, let me plug this and I'll answer your question. The Brain to Books Cyber Convention is online. Mm-hmm. People can Google it and find it fairly easily. But there's panels and giveaways and cover wars and character wars and all sorts of different things. But in those panels, you'll find where we've spent an hour and 51 minutes talking about fantasy and how it's changed over the past 80 years and how we've developed, as well as all sorts of other things. But you'll find me at the Brains to Book Convention next weekend. April 7th through 9th is the time that's going to be going on. So check out that website. But to answer your question, I think that there has been a lot of recycling of fantasy, which I think is really pretty true of our generation. I mean, how many reboots of movies have we seen in the past 20 years? We're constantly seeing rebooting of a lot of different things in terms of media. But I do think there's been some changes as well. And for me, the biggest change in fantasy that I've noticed, apart from Tolkien, is that Tolkien's fantasy was very black and white. There's a lot of duality in terms of good and evil, and this epic battle that was taking place between light and dark. And I think fantasy nowadays is shifting more towards the George R. R. Martin mentality, where even your bad guys aren't necessarily in the wrong. You get this more multi-scope character perspective coming from different directions, and it's really hard to distinguish who's right and who's wrong, who's necessarily fighting for good, who's fighting for evil, and it leaves the reader contemplating and kind of questioning their own existence too. And I see that as being a reflection on society. Yeah. I see us more and more in society questioning necessarily the good and the bad.
Sure.
So, another piece that goes into that is that fantasy has always served that purpose. Fantasy, I think, oftentimes is a genre where we can reflect back on society and say things in allegory that people aren't necessarily brave enough to say yet.
Right. Yeah. Because there's some distance between that world and ours.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, I think there's probably also an element of there's certain, you know, archetypes and things like that, they never really get old, and people like to hear the story over and over and over again, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's definitely true. I mean, you always want the underdog to win. We still see that frequently. We still see, you know, the epic, you know, chosen one type of thing. I mean, we're all the heroes of our own stories. And so we like to read about the people that become heroes from something smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because I write primarily sort of fairy tale kind of things, and you know, with my daughter, we read a lot of fairy tales and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to kind of see, you know, these things from, you know, thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago or whatever. They're not really that much different. I mean, when you boil them down, you have a hero or a heroine and their journey, and you know, there's certain things that come up in all the different stories around the world. It's really kind of interesting to see like how that really doesn't change that much. And that's okay, I think, to some extent.
Yeah, I think it is too. I don't know the stats on it anymore. I did way back in the day, but they talk about how there's really only like 7 main stories that keep getting repeated in different ways over and over and over again across genres. There's not a whole lot of difference in the actual story itself.
Right, right. Well, you know, I know that you had mentioned that there's some new stuff that you're planning in terms of releasing over in your horizon, over the next, you know, next year, I guess. Can you say about that?
Sure. A lot of people know that my co-writer is JC Boyd, who is also my younger brother. And so he and I, like to sit down together and, you know, tear apart each other's writing and critique it and put together something that we like. But right now we're working on a novel that'll be introducing his fantasy world called Jorth, which is a much darker world than even my own. And for the novel that we're currently working on, it's called Blood and Bile. We're hoping to see it out in May, beginning of June, and it's featuring the giants of the north in his world who get infected by a hunger spirit. And this hunger spirit essentially turns the giants into zombies, and they eat their own kind. The more they eat, the bigger they grow, looking to be anywhere between 12 to 20 foot tall. And when they get so large, they start vomiting up spawn that, again, are zombie in nature and start attacking their own people. And so it's their own little plague and how they deal with it in a very old world. The language is going to be very similar to what you're going to find in things like Beowulf, and Old Norse sagas.
Yeah. Cool. So that's something you're working on together then.
Yes, it is. Yeah, we've essentially finished up the rough draft of the story. It's going through developmental edits right now.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
At any one time, because it seems like you got a lot of fires or irons in the fire, I guess. Like, how many things do you have going at the same time at this point?
You know, I typically only try to keep one iron in the fire lately, but things have kind of exploded in the past couple of months as I'm balancing a number of different things. So right now I have this book that's going through developmental edits and two books on the table that I'm writing. So it's more than I've taken on at a given time before. It's becoming a little bit more difficult to balance.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, sort of coming full circle here in the start of the show, we had talked about you'd made the leap to full-time author. I mean, what is a for someone who's not an author, or someone who's thinking about becoming one, or just even curious about what that would look like? What does a typical day for you look like, if there is such a thing?
I do have typical days. Yeah. So I generally get up about 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. We have a handful of goblins here at the house, of course, our kiddos we got to take care of. So it's getting them up and around and getting them off to school. I usually get back home around 7:40 or so after dropping them off. I sit down for about 6 hours. I'm breaking only for lunch. And I do marketing and writing. Marketing usually takes about an hour and a half, and then I do writing after that. Sure. Then I go pick up the kids in the afternoon, bring them back home. I run through all the evening routine, supper, homework, showers, get them back off to bed, and I'll usually write again for a couple of hours before I go to bed. That's generally my typical day. Gotcha. Some days are primarily going out and talking to bookstores and talking to comic shops and making phone calls to people in other cities about, you know, necessarily getting my books in their stores.
Sure.
So there's some days that are primarily for that, but I generally write about 8 hours a day.
Wow. And do you have a particular goal that you aim for the day, or is it just sort of whatever happens, happens?
I typically aim for about 4,000 words a day. Some days it's 2,000, some days it's 6,000, but 4 is about where I try to aim for, which is a typical chapter for me. About 4,000 to 4,500 words is a typical chapter. So it's about a chapter a day is what I try to achieve.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think of what 250 words is like a typical page, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I typically write about 800 to 1200 words an hour, depending on how in the scene I am.
Yeah.
So sometimes I can get the writing done in 4 hours. Sometimes if I'm just not being able to stay focused and get it done, it may take me the full 6 hours in the morning to do it.
Right.
And I guess I should add in there, usually in the morning, I spend the first hour, hour and a half going through the chapter I wrote yesterday and kind of editing before I move on and start writing again.
Of course, there's also that part.
Yeah. I have to edit. I do edit as I go along. Some people say not to do that, but I actually find it very helpful when I get the book finished and I get to go back through and edit.
Yeah.
So I edit as I write.
Right. You know, when you go out and look at the different opportunities or the different places, I guess, to put your book out there, I mean, obviously there's online, there's the traditional sort of brick and mortar kind of places. How do you end up prioritizing like what you want to devote your time to?
Well, right now, my books, of course, are on distribution through Amazon, and it's a print-on-demand service. I've not moved over to Ingram Spark or other companies like that.
Yeah.
So who I'm able to approach to get my books published is fairly selective. They got to be people that are willing to either do consignment or willing to take a risk on me as a person. So a lot of it as an indie author, I think, really comes down to building relationships with local community.
Yeah.
And then as that expands out, it's those people you've built relationships with vouching for you.
Sure. Yeah. And have you had more success in like bookstores or comic book places or things like that? What's been your favorite, I guess, or favorite? Or
I got to tell you that I love the indie bookstores. There's a lot of independent bookstores around North Carolina, and the people are very supportive of indie authors and their works. And so it's pretty, I want to say it's easy, but it's not extremely difficult to go in and talk to them and talk about doing a book signing and getting your books on their shelves. I think a lot of the barriers for the indie author is just getting up the guts to go and just talk to them to begin with and see what their options are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It comes down to like, cojones, I guess. Right. You know, just to go do it. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting, the I think it usually ends up coming down to that, you know, making that personal connection and, you know, spending the time and, you know, getting to know people as people, and then they finally naturally become more interested in what you do. And that's been my experience at the conventions as well, because people often come up and take information and stuff like that. But when you start talking to somebody and hear the story and all that kind of stuff, then it kind of naturally flows out of that.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, which I think is only human. I think you and I both know that in our field of work, so.
Cool. Well, is there where can people go to find out more information about you? This is I'll put stuff in the show notes, but I mean, if there's anything in particular you want to plug or whatever.
Sure, yeah. Go to robertsonwrites.com. It's robertsonwrites.com. I just updated the site. It's very pretty and easy to bounce around on.
Looks
You'll
very
find a
nice.
couple of radio interviews on there about with me, as well as links to all my stuff. I got a free book on Amazon right now. It's perma-free, so I encourage people to go and download it, read it, leave me a review.
And what's the name
And
of
I think the
that, so they
coolest thing
know?
about oh,
What's the
go
name
ahead.
of the freebie, so people
The
can check
freebie
that out?
is The Name of Death.
The Name of Death. Okay.
The Name of Death, yep. And the coolest thing about my website right now is that there's a link at the top called Thrice Nine Legends. And if you click
Okay.
on that, you are going to jump into my world. You're going to see the gods, the very unique magic system, the races, the monsters, the history of the world. You can see the wonderful map that was done by Joseph Vandal. You can honestly spend probably 3 or 4 hours just going through links on my website and exploring the world. It's stuff you're not going to find in the books. It's for the people that just really like to nerd out about that type of thing. And then the other place to find me, of course, is Robertson Writes on
On
Twitter. That's
Twitter.
probably another one of the best places to find me.
Okay, so you'll find links to those things in the show notes, and then I'll also link to our the first show that we did you know, a year and change ago. And so you can, you know, sort of get a sort of before and after. There's so much happened in the last year. That's awesome to hear. So I'm happy, very happy for you.
I appreciate it. I'm almost scared to listen to that first show. No, I think it was good. I think it was
That
good.
was one of the first shows that I did where there was a guest. And so I haven't listened to it in quite a while either. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things I remember you saying on that show is that, you know, it takes several years for typically an author to kind of, I guess, pay their dues, I guess, you know, probably, I think you said 5 years. It's good to hear for, I think, the folks who are like, you know, in the midst of the grind. And they're like, well, you know, when are things going to kind of turn around? And it's good to see that it does happen. So.
And you really, this is advice for any listeners out there that do want to become writers. I've said this time and time again. You've got to go out and be part of a writing community. There are a lot of great communities, even on Facebook, that will give you the tips and the tricks that you need to advance your career as a writer. And you need to get involved to make those personal connections. I started building my platform as a writer 2 years before I published my first book, which helped me tremendously as a blogger. I was connecting with people and I had a lot of, I think, strong connections in the community before I ever put that first book out there.
It's so important. And if it, you know, I stay, I tried to stay connected to a writing group that I was a part of when I lived in New England. And even though I don't live there anymore, you know, once you find a good community of folks, I mean, even if you can only communicate them, you know, through online and the occasional, you know, convention or whatever like that, you know, it's I found that it's worth it. It really does make a big difference. It's so hard to do it totally solo, you know, in isolation. So,
Yeah, I'd agree.
thank you very much, Josh, for coming on. It's always a pleasure to have you on. You're always welcome back, and I look forward to seeing what happens with you over, you know, next couple months, next year, whatever. So,
I appreciate it. Thanks, Josh.
yeah, absolutely.